From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, 2015 marks a new chapter for U.S. and Cuba relations, and now?
People want to go to Cuba and find this place that's not capitalist, this place that's somehow authentic and real.
But what's really waiting for us once we travel to Cuba? Plus, the North American International Auto Show is in full swing. We look at the latest in green vehicles.
Things that seem conventional are really getting much better fuel economy. You've got 7, 8, 9, and soon we're going to even have 10-speed automatic transmissions.
Plus, how much do Americans support the EPA's Clean Power Plan? A new survey offers some answers.
This is a little different question. How do you want your state to respond?
Those stories and much more today on Stateside.
President Obama speaking to the Cubans directly, saying, no es fácil, it's not easy, but it was just so exciting.
This year marks a new chapter for U.S. and Cuba relations, and now?
People want to go to Cuba and find this place that's not capitalist, this place that's somehow authentic and real.
But what is really there? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll hear what restoring ties with Cuba means for one Michigan woman. But first, Americans from coast to coast have been rejoicing at the dramatic slide in gasoline prices. But what of the automakers who are plugging away, making green vehicles? The green vehicles that Uncle Sam's demanding, and then the automakers are trying to get us, the car-buying public, to embrace them. Writer Paul Eisenstein covers the auto industry as publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul serves up an in-depth look at the state of alternative fuel vehicles in the January issue of our Detroit magazine. Welcome back, Paul.
Good to be with you.
You have covered all of the news conferences, all of the big vehicle reveals at the North American International Auto Show this year. And amidst the luscious luxury cars and those muscle cars, like that new 650-horsepower Corvette you recently test drove, you lucky dog. But the automakers are still thinking green, aren't they?
Yeah, and what's very interesting is they're thinking green and performance at the same time. One of the big previews at the Detroit Auto Show was, you ready for this?
What?
A 550-horsepower hybrid. Ooh. It's called the Acura NSX. So if you were to peel back that beautiful skin, what you would discover underneath is a V6 gas engine and an electric motor powering the rear wheels. And it's, by the way, a turbocharged engine. And then on the front, you have two electric motors, one for each wheel. So you have all-wheel drive, you have a concept called torque vectoring, which uses power to help steer you through a corner, and when you are nailing it, well, we expect they're going to be doing 0 to 60 in about 3 seconds or so. At the other extreme, when you are just taking it easy, I wouldn't be surprised if they have, when the EPA finishes the numbers, better than 40 miles a gallon in terms of highway driving.
You know, that is important because performance has been a question when you talk about the alternatives. I mean, I want to be green, but boy, I want to have some fun when I'm driving and not plugging earnestly along in the slow lane.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what's really cool about what's going on right now. We are seeing an explosion of performance. It is the golden age of muscle cars, believe it or not. Look, you've got that 700-horsepower Dodge Charger and the Dodge Challenger. You've got the 650-horsepower Corvette Z06, like you mentioned earlier. And then you have the Corvette Stingray, which is only 450-horsepower, the base car. But who could imagine a 450-horsepower car doing 0 to 60 in less than 4 seconds that is also getting 31 miles a gallon on the highway?
Well, because as we talk about all these fun muscle cars, and I know there were a lot of great luxury cars that were also revealed, you've got the auto companies saying, yeah, but we've got this issue of these tough new CAFE standards that start phasing in next year. So they need to meet those. And in that way, they need to get us interested in alternate fuel vehicles.
Yeah, even some things that seem fairly conventional are really getting much better fuel economy because of all sorts of improvements under the hood. You've got 7, 8, 9, and soon we're going to even have 10-speed automatic transmissions. You have turbocharging. I mentioned that the NSX also is turbocharged. Look at the Ford F-150. This is a great example of how the world has changed. That vehicle, you know, it's a big truck, and you associate that with what? Big block V8 engines, right?
Yes.
Except half of the F-150s that Ford sells right now are powered by V6s. There are two new versions using the so-called EcoBoost engine. These are turbocharged engines. And in fact, the most capable version of the Ford F-150, the new aluminum one, is a turbocharged V6, not a V8. That tells you how the world has changed.
I'm talking with automotive writer Paul Eisenstein. His story in Our Detroit, current issue, is considering the alternatives. You know, it isn't easy going green, but they're working at it. Let's talk a little about the 2016 Volt. Why do you feel that's particularly good news for Michigan?
It's pretty good news for Detroit and for General Motors because, first of all, I think it'll be a lot more competitive of a vehicle than the first generation model that they had. For Detroit and for the region, it's important because they are moving a lot of the production of components for this vehicle, the plug-in hybrid, to Michigan. I think 70% of the vehicle will be produced in Michigan, down to some of the electric powertrain systems that were not produced here before. Now, this is a real transition. The original Volt was the first mass market plug-in hybrid. And for those who don't know what plug-ins are, they have a combination of a regular gasoline engine and a battery motor, electric vehicle system. What it's designed to do is drive initially or primarily under battery power, but when you run the charge down, unlike a regular battery vehicle, the gas engine will fire up and it'll keep it going. And that's a big transition. You don't have to worry about range anxiety in this case.
And I think range anxiety, when I talk with anyone I know, friends, just conversations about EVs, the biggest concerns are the range anxieties and charge times. Because didn't those early EVs take up to a day to recharge?
Some of them can. And even now, if you're going to charge from a 110 volt outlet, you're going to spend a lot of time charging. Now, one of the things that happens is the Volt upgrades its internal combustion engine to an all-new design that's quieter, more fuel efficient. It's also getting an improved battery pack. It's smaller, lighter, yet more powerful. And this is where batteries are going. They're going to be smaller, lighter, more powerful, and cheaper. We should be seeing battery prices drop substantially in the next few years. So you have room for 5, not 4. You don't have this big tunnel where a lot of the battery pack is between the passengers, left and right. And it'll get up to 50 miles on a charge before the gas engine kicks in. Now, that's starting to push in the territory of some of the regular pure battery electric vehicles on the road. GM's estimating that 90% of Volt buyers, 90% of motorists in America in general, would be able to use that car without ever running the gas. They're expecting that on average, Volt users will go 1,500 miles between fill-ups.
Wow.
And they're already at 900, which is significant. GM also brought out the Chevy Bolt. I know it's confusing people. The name will probably change by the time they get to production. The Bolt is going to take the electric vehicle, they hope, into a new category, more mainstream. Most of them right now get 75 to maybe 100 miles range. The rare exception has been the Tesla, a Model S, which can get up to 300 if you want to spend $80,000 to get the big battery pack. The Bolt will be around $30,000 after all the tax credits and the like, and that should get you 200 miles range, and that's significant. But more importantly, expect to see a lot of conventional vehicles, gas-powered vehicles, that will be using electrification to allow them to get better fuel economy. And then there's another issue. That is, of course, the corporate average fuel economy mandate, which jumps a fair bit by 16,
right,
and then takes a huge jump to 54.5 mpg by 2025. And by the way, we're not the toughest. If you go over to Europe, they focus on CO2 content, and the numbers they set are even more demanding. I think it works out to something like 70 miles a gallon. And China is cracking down, and Japan's cracking down. In fact, China really wants to go as much as possible to a nearly all-electric fleet of automobiles, so they're leaning on consumers very hard to make the switch.
Can't let you go without us touching on diesels and hydrogen power.
Diesels, interesting technology that virtually vanished from the United States because the diesels of the 80s were so bad. And suddenly Europe, over the last decade or so, developed new diesels, primarily using turbocharging, and they became great, high fuel efficiency, much cleaner, and they also stopped stinking. They were quick. I mean, there are some high-performance diesels out there. Audi's been winning Le Mans, the endurance races, and some others, running a diesel race car. So in Europe, they're almost half of the new vehicle market. Here, they are growing. They're still very small. The big problem is that while they get a lot better mileage, the price of diesel has not been plunging like the price of gasoline. So that's an issue.
Yes. And hydrogen, how close are we to a hydrogen transition that's for real?
But if you're looking at a time when hydrogen is a significant player in the automotive market, that's a good distance away. But the first hydrogen car on the road in recent times came from Hyundai, of all people. It's a version of their Tucson Sport utility vehicle. And we are about to see an all-new dedicated hydrogen vehicle from Toyota called the Mirai, which will be here by mid-year. And then Honda will be in 2016. Here's a conundrum. Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, but it's not readily available. You have to get it through all sorts of complex things. You electrolyze water, you crack natural gas. There's a ready supply of it. You see it out in California. They use it a lot for industrial purposes. And California does have a network in Southern California. The state has passed legislation putting a lot of money aside to create a hydrogen infrastructure, and there's private money going into it. Honda and Toyota are both funding some of that. Now, here's the good thing. For those who do want hydrogen, the newest technology seems to be reasonably quick and competitive. You can get up to 300 miles on a tank full, and it takes 3 or 5 minutes to fill your tank, much like you would if you were putting in gasoline.
Fascinating stuff. Lots to think about as we consider the alternatives. Paul Eisenstein covers the auto industry. He's publisher of thedetroitbureau.com, and you can find his in-depth look at the state of alternative fuel vehicles in the January issue of Our Detroit magazine. Paul, thanks so much.
My pleasure to be with you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow is in Cuba today, meeting and talking with Cuban officials. She's part of the congressional delegation visiting the island after President Obama's decision last month to overhaul our Cuban policy. Reestablishing diplomatic ties that were cut with the 1962 embargo has a lot of people talking about visiting Cuba. But what would we find? Is Cuba indeed a country frozen in time, as many Americans believe? Here to talk about this is Ruth Behar. She's a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan, and she's the daughter of Cuban exiles. She was born in Cuba, and her family left in the 1960s. Ruth Behar, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You had a piece that was published recently in the Washington Post and many other papers about what President Obama's decision meant to you and your parents. And you also have just got a piece out in the Huffington Post about what visitors to Cuba might and might not find. I want to start with those emotions that you felt when you got word of these changing American views and policies towards your homeland.
Thanks for the question. Yeah, well, it was intense. My heart was definitely going a mile a minute. I was so excited after such a long freeze to see the possibility of an opening of relations, which seemed like it would never happen. It really seemed like an eternal situation that we would just be going on with forever and ever, this kind of strange, you know, lack of relation between the U.S. and Cuba. But on the other hand, lots of grassroots relationships with Cuba, lots of people like me traveling to Cuba and making our own contacts with Cubans and with Cuban culture and Cuban memory. But then officially this sense of this freeze between the two governments. And it had a lot to do with pride on both sides. The American government didn't want to bow down to a small Caribbean nation that had dared to go communist 90 miles away from our borders. And then on the other hand, Cuba, with its own pride of national sovereignty didn't want to have to bow to the U.S. either. So how was this conflict ever going to be resolved? I think it had a lot to do with actually male pride. And when suddenly there was this possibility of an opening and President Obama speaking to the Cubans directly in his speech, you know, and saying, no es fácil, it's not easy. But it was just so exciting. So I was thrilled. And at the same time, since all Cuban Americans are like this, we also carry our community, you know, on our backs. And I carry my parents' stories and that whole inheritance of knowing that my parents fled in the 60s, that they left Cuba at a very, very difficult time when you could be harassed and mistreated and persecuted for wanting to leave the country. It was a highly politicized time. You could call it a sort of political fundamentalism took root in Cuba, and you were either for the revolution or against it. There was no middle place that you could occupy. And if you chose to leave, you were a worm of the revolution.
And that's what you and your family were branded as.
And that's what we were branded. We were branded worms. So knowing what my parents went through, I was a child. I was only 4 and a half. And knowing what they went through and then seeing my father work 3 jobs when we got to New York, which is where I grew up, it was so painful. So immediately I was thrilled, but that happiness was muted by knowing that my parents had suffered. And was their grief being taken into account in this sudden opening and excitement? What about the grief of people like my parents, this older generation, many of whom have never been back, who've had this position of we're not going back until the political system changes? And I think it's a position of great integrity, and I respect it. So these are people that would love to go back. They have a lot of nostalgia for Cuba, but they made a vow to themselves not to go back until that regime changes, until the Castros are out of power. And that's the position that my father in particular holds on to. My mother is much more sentimental, and she cried when she read my piece in the Washington Post. She called to tell me she was weeping as she read it. She said, I really, really want to go back. I want to see Cuba again. I'm afraid, you know, that it won't be the Cuba I remember, but I still want to go. But she's so respectful of my father's position that she won't go unless he goes.
And right now he's still taking the hard line,
isn't he? He's still taking the hard line and saying, you know, this is not a good idea because it means that the U.S. is supporting a tyrannical government, a government that doesn't respect free speech. And so like many in that line of thought, he just doesn't really think this is a good move. He thinks that the U.S. should have waited a little longer and just seen if the Castro government, you know, just eventually left power somehow. I think others of us felt that, you know, it's been a long time. It's been 50 plus years. And these are the people in government. These are the people that we need to negotiate with. And then we always need to think that ultimately what we want is the best for the Cuban people. So if this is going to be the best for the Cuban people, then it's the thing to do.
And you felt compelled to write for the Huffington Post about something that a lot of people have been saying ever since the president's announcement. Basically goes like this: I need to get to Cuba before it gets Americanized and too modernized and loses what makes it special. So as someone who was born there and someone who's traveled there a lot, what's your reaction to that?
There are lots of stereotypes about Cuba. It's to be expected. It's been the forbidden place, you know, for over 50 years. So lots of stereotypes and fantasies have been created about Cuba. And we have all the fantasies from before the revolution as well. So we have basically two sets of fantasies. We have the fantasies from the 50s. And so Cuba as this place of music and gambling and prostitution and the high life and all of that, right? And, you know, this incredible beach resort and all of that.
I've so heard people fondly remembering wild times in the 50s.
Wild times in the 50s. Yes. So we've got that whole image of Cuba. It was the place where you could go and let go, you know, and it was also the place where people went to drink, you know, during Prohibition. So there's all of this sort of Cuba as that place of letting go, you know. So there's all of those images, fantasies, stereotypes, desires placed upon Cuba that have to do with what Cuba was like before the revolution. But then there are all the fantasies that have been created since the revolution. It's like, oh, these are like the revolutionaries. They're the most different people and place from the United States that you can possibly imagine. No McDonald's there, you know, no Taco Bell, you know,
no mega resorts.
So this is kind of like the other to American capitalism. So you have these two sets of fantasies coming together in how Cuba is perceived. And all of that has to do with, I think, with an image of Cuba as a place preserved in amber, as a place frozen in time, as a place that hasn't changed. And so we have to get there now before it changes. That's what I hear. I hear it all the time from very intelligent people. I need to get there before it changes. And
your reaction is, well, wait a minute, folks, it hasn't been frozen in amber.
It hasn't been frozen in amber. It has been changing like any society and culture. It's always evolving and changing. The Cuba of the 60s when the revolution began is not the Cuba that we're seeing now with Raul Castro in power, with the pragmatist brother in power. It's not the Cuba of Fidel Castro, but it's not the Cuba of the heyday of the revolution of the 60s when they thought we're going to change the world, you know. And what they did is they brought the world to them, but they didn't change the world exactly in the way that they wanted. You know, so the Cuba of the 60s is not the Cuba of the 21st century. These are different Cubas. Cuba has been evolving. And so Cuba has been changing, and people want to go to Cuba, especially very well-meaning Americans want to go to Cuba and find this place that's not capitalist, this place that's somehow authentic and primitive and real, where people live from dreams, you know, basically. Mm. And it's just not that way. Cuba is this very complex, very contradictory place. There still is a communist system in place, but on the other hand, people are finding various ways to be capitalist entrepreneurs. So it's this place really of complex contradiction. And that's what I'm really seeing in Cuba. So you're not going to go and find this place where everybody is either kind of a 50s cha-cha-cha dancer.
Like Desi Arnaz,
you know, who I loved. Yes. Or, you know, or everybody's wearing a Che t-shirt and going, yay, I'm a revolutionary. Let's keep making revolution. It's not one or the other. It's actually very, very complex, where those ideas crisscross, where you have many generational differences as well, where you have people from the older generation who actually remember pre-59 Cuba, and kind of their sense of what's going on is very different from somebody born in the 90s, when Cuba already was changing and opening up to capitalism after the fall of the Soviet Union. And so kids who grew up after the 90s or in this century don't remember all of that revolutionary stuff. You know, it's nostalgia
just
for
life.
Them too. It's just life, yeah. You know, and they want an iPhone. I mean, they, you know, they want to live in the 21st century like every other young person, you know. And the other thing that's happened that I think is very curious and interesting is I think politics was really so pushed onto people that now there's been a kind of response to it where people are very apolitical in Cuba, or they've moved into things like religion, because religion was suppressed throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s. And in the 90s, it became possible to actually have a religious faith and be a member of the Communist Party. And Cubans have really a strong sense of faith, particularly in the Afro-Cuban religions, and all of that had to go underground. And in the 90s, it kind of came back up into the fore. And so you see lots of people all over Cuba dressed completely in white from head to toe. And it's because they've been initiated into Santeria. And so you see that they have to wear white for a year. And that wasn't possible during the heyday of the revolution, because they wanted people to stop believing in religion and to believe in the possibility of humans making change. It was that whole sort of communist perspective, atheist perspective. And they enforced that on people, and people kind of tried their best to live that way, but it didn't fit with the Cuban character, where there's such a sense of faith and belief in spirituality. And so that's all kind of come back into the mix. And so you have just so many things mixed together, a fusion of so many different ways of thinking and of acting in the world. And that's what I think makes Cuba super exciting.
And Americans need to adjust their thoughts and give up the fantasy and be prepared to embrace the reality of what Cuba's like in 2015. I'm wondering, what are your hopes and fears for Cuba with this change in policy?
Well, my hopes, of course, are that, you know, the lives of everyday Cubans will improve greatly, that they'll have access to more things that they don't have easy access to now. You know, people are aware that internet is something that Cubans don't have easy access to. It doesn't mean they don't have access to it at all. They do. They find ways around the system. I have this acquaintance who gets, you know, time on the internet through a friend of a friend who's married to a Spaniard who has full access. And so she buys time from this person. And, you know, and she can get on and see what's for sale at Target, you know, and I think that's amazing. And to me, that shows that Cubans are not primitive others, as they're sometimes, you know, thought to be by Americans who haven't been there. But in fact, they're super savvy, postmodern people. They've kind of figured out the capitalist system. They've figured out the system that tries to suppress them in Cuba. And they've figured out all these ways around these systems that seek to block them, because there's this, kind of this internal blockade as well, as opposed to the external blockade imposed by the U.S. There's this internal blockade denying them access to certain things, whether it's the internet, whether it's certain consumer goods. But they find a way around all this. And to me, that makes them the super savviest people. And I think that's something that Americans really need to think about. They're not just going to, you know, connect with these primitives that are out in a jungle, you know, and they're barefoot, and, you know, and they don't know about modern life. They actually are, they're way beyond, because they really have figured out all these ways around, you know, a system that would seek to suppress them. They have really figured out a way to be free. And I think that's what makes Cubans such an amazing people.
Ruth's piece in the Huffington Post is entitled The Fantasy of a Cuba Where Time Stood Still. Ruth is a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. Born in Cuba, her family fled that country in the 1960s. Ruth Behar, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
On this Martin Luther King Day, let's consider the 2014 Word of the Year from the American Dialect Society. Now, other groups around the world offer up their Word of the Year choices, but this one comes from the nation's top grammarians and linguists, including my guest, Sanja Lainhart. She's a professor of linguistics at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and she's a Wolverine. She did her master's and her PhD at the University of Michigan. Sanja, the American Dialect Word of the Year for 2014 is?
Hashtag Black Lives Matter.
Why did you advocate for that?
A few months ago, when all of the turmoil was going on, and even not just with police brutality towards African Americans, but also some issues related to black women as well, I put it in my smartphone that that is the word that I was going to nominate, and that is the word that I was going to push to have be Word of the Year, because I thought it was important. I see this as sort of a defining moment in our civil rights history right now. There have been lots of attacks against African Americans, whether it's voting rights or walking while black or driving while black or just being a black woman. And I thought it was about time that our organization said something important, not that what we haven't done is important, but to make a statement.
And tell me about the vote.
I was absolutely shocked. Not only did hashtag Black Lives Matter win Word of the Year, it won in two categories, and overwhelmingly. I've never seen in the category, I think it was most necessary, it won, I think it was like 200, out of 200 and say 40 votes, it had 228 votes. So that part was overwhelming. And the amount of support that other people gave, not only for nominating hashtag Black Lives Matter, but also nominating and in some cases winning for other words related to issues in not just African American communities, but for people of color more widely. So, for example, Columbusing won in a category. Even Misogynoir was nominated in a category. So there was more of this cognizance that black people are a part of this country, a part of this organization, and we need to take note of that.
Talk to me as a linguist. Hashtag Black Lives Matter is now seen as a word, because would some might say it's a phrase with three words, no?
Right. So we've had this issue in the past with words. Hashtag Black Lives Matter is not one word, obviously, but it is a lexical unit. The American Dialect Society, when they are nominating, it can be phrases as well, because those are still lexical units, and they have significance in our lexicon.
When we join together today in thinking about Dr. King and his legacy and his vision, how do you hope hashtag Black Lives Matter will advance that legacy and his vision for equality?
I think it does, in the sense that I think I always hate to hear when people say, "Well, if Martin Luther King were alive today, he'd be in favor of what I'm doing." So I don't want to say that, but I would say that I think this is a legacy of what he has done at the time that he lived, and as he's continued in our hearts and minds and thoughts as well. So especially with Selma being out and sort of the controversy around Selma not being recognized, it's sort of nice that at least the American Dialect Society has recognized something for civil rights and for black people in particular. So I think it's a part of that legacy, in that in addition to why I wanted to nominate it, it had to do with the fact that so many young people have become a part of this movement, right? So hashtag Black Lives Matter is all over the internet. It's part of the black Twitterati. It's something that young people are behind. And as a matter of fact, at the American Dialect Society Word of the Year vote, it was mostly young people who were really advocating for this? Because historically, the American Dialect Society has sort of skewed more towards an older demographic, so it's been nice to see that sort of interaction. And I think it's important that we recognize young people's voices, considering the fact that they are going to be our future, or they are our future, and they are taking such an active role in what's going on and what has happened. And it's become a part of their psyche.
Sanja Lainhart is a member of the American Dialect Society, which overwhelmingly chose hashtag Black Lives Matter for 2014 Word of the Year. It was good to talk with you, Sanja. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Go blue.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There has been plenty of discussion, a lot written, about climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. But are we ready to actually do something substantive about reducing those emissions? Based on a new public opinion survey by CLOSUP, the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at U of M's Ford School of Public Policy, the answer appears to be yes. Barry Rabe's with us now. He directs CLOSUP. Your survey was centered around the EPA's Clean Power Plan, its greenhouse gas reduction initiative. Just remind us again what it calls for.
This is not a new act of legislation, something passed by Congress, but rather President Obama's decision over recent years to go back to clean air legislation passed in 1990 and begin to apply that to carbon dioxide standards. In this case, the Clean Power Plan would address carbon emissions from all operational power plants in the U.S. and then over a period of time, more than a decade, create a fairly substantial reduction in their carbon emissions. It's a national standard. It's a federal set of requirements, but every state gets to put together its own plan, working from a big, big menu in deciding how they're going to achieve those reductions. Michigan, Montana, Texas, every state negotiating with EPA, but the state taking the lead.
So it really brings a lot of voices into the discussion of how to enact this. What did you find in your survey as far as the overall idea of the Clean Power Plan and the idea of reducing greenhouse gas from these power plants?
And this is a national telephone survey completed late last year after the policy had been introduced at the very end of a massive public comment period and public hearings around the country and a lot of media attention. We found 2/3 responded favorably to the idea of the Clean Power Plan. That's based on a fairly extended explanation of what was in it, looking at a national basis, with some differences, indeed, between Republicans and Democrats, but 2 out of 3 folks saying that they would support it, and actually an even higher percentage, about 70%, supporting the earlier version, which would apply these standards to newly developed or newly proposed power plants.
So 2/3 of us on board with the Clean Power Plan, and just a little bit more are in support, significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions from new power plants. Were you surprised by this? Was this stronger than you'd thought it was going to be?
Again, this is pretty new. It is very difficult to put a price tag on it, in part because each state has to put its own program or plan together. But one of the things that we did, and we think that this was a little more surprising in terms of our findings, is going beyond, gee, what do you think about the Clean Power Plan, and how do you want your state to respond?
What did you hear?
What we're seeing is states going in 1 of 3 directions. In some cases, states are kind of on board with this and actively beginning to negotiate with the U.S. EPA. Some states are waiting to see what happens. And the third group is actually bringing litigation, suing EPA. Wisconsin just announced last week that they were going to do this. When we put that trio of questions before our respondents and said, how do you want your state to respond to this? We found that less than 10% wanted to take the third option, to oppose, to litigate. The largest percentage was to actively cooperate with the EPA, but the second largest then was to delay and wait and see what happens. And so that means that a little more than 9 out of 10 Americans do not like the idea of their state suing the federal government, but want to see at least some early engagement or some further review, which really did surprise us, especially because a good number of states have already begun to say, or at least their political leaders have begun to say, we're not going to go along with this, and they're looking at suing the federal government.
And where does Michigan stand? What have we heard from Governor Snyder?
Very little has been said thus far about what Michigan would be doing with the Clean Power Plan response, although it's safe to say that there's been some study groups working in Lansing on this. What we have not heard from officials in Michigan, including the governor, is what we heard just last week from Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin, which was, we think this is bad for the economy and we're going to join forces with Texas and some southern states and try to fight this in the courts.
I see that figure that only 9% of those surveyed want their state to, like, let's sue, let's not cooperate. Do you think that bespeaks kind of an overall feeling by the public that, gosh, we're sick of the fighting. Can we just talk at least?
I think that may be the case. We don't see this kind of question asked a lot in surveys about federal versus state. It's more, you know, gee, do you like your federal government? Do you like state and local governments? And how do those compare? I think it's interesting to then think how this might apply to other areas like state cooperation or refusal to cooperate with the Affordable Care Act and other areas. We were just taking one piece of this with the Clean Power Plan, but that may suggest some degree to try to work things out if at all possible, at least at the early stages of a program like this where there are a whole bunch of options on the table, including what you would actually like to see in a state's Clean Power Plan if the state went ahead and started working with Washington.
And what did people tell you?
Here we found very, very strong support for two options. The runaway winner here are energy efficiency mandates or requirements to regularly, perhaps on an annual basis, increase the amount of energy efficiency within a state. About 26 states already have policies along these lines, but many of them are coming up for renewal. This had overwhelming support and actually very broad support from both Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. Coming in a close second were mandates for renewable electricity. 29 states have these. Michigan has one, although we're going to reach our target deadline this year. There's questions about what happens next. The governor may be talking about that. That was very well received, again, both by Republicans and Democrats. What's clearly less popular were so-called market-based policies, the very policies that most economists argue are the best way to go at the issue of climate change. And here, policies like cap and trade and carbon taxes fared far, far worse, both amongst Republicans and Democrats, than the other policies that I mentioned. Really staggering differences in this regard. And 10 states do have cap and trade, and one possible option for cap and trade is either a state creating its own or joining up with partnerships with existing states. But that didn't fare very well in the survey.
Barry, how do you hope the data that you and your team have collected will be used, and by whom?
There was a massive comment period by US EPA that was extended out until right at the very, very end of our survey. And we will be sending this material into the agency with much more detail than we're able to provide in our report as they begin to sort of sift through this, in part because we think we're asking a few questions that have not been asked before. We also thought it was really important to get a baseline on this so that we can begin to compare how this plays out over time. There are going to be challenges to this approach, including litigation, including the possibility that the next president would be less supportive of this approach. We don't know how this is going to play out longer term, but if, in fact, it does go forward, we really wanted to create a baseline so that anyone could begin to look now at where the public is on this issue and then how that might change over time as the policy goes further into development, as perhaps these policies begin to be refined, or maybe it plays out in the courts. So this is just an initial snapshot of something that could be going for quite some time, and we wanted to be part of that process.
Barry Rabe is a U of M professor of public policy. He directs Close Up, the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. And we have put a link on our website to the latest study issues in energy and environmental policy. Good talking with you, Barry. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to talk with you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Intuition. Curiosity.
The next idea.
There is no straight path from your seat today to where you are going. Don't try to draw that line. You will not just get it wrong. You will miss big opportunities.
Between now and January 25th, tens of thousands of people will pour into Cobo Center on Detroit's riverfront for the North American International Auto Show. They'll be scoping out the newest, shiniest, most innovative vehicles the auto industry can offer. So let's take a little time now and think about some of these innovations because they could help strengthen and diversify Michigan's economy. Jeff DeGraff is back with us. He's a clinical professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. And, of course, he is Michigan Radio's partner for The Next Idea. Jeff, your latest essay for The Next Idea is looking at autos. And I thought what I heard you say is, yes, the world sees Michigan as sort of a one-trick pony, automotive, automotive, automotive. And yes, there are calls for the state's economy to diversify, but it's actually the auto industry that can help that to happen from the inside out.
Yes. You have to do what you actually know how to do, and you also have to do what you're known for doing. So I think these are really big pluses for us. But one of the things I think that people often miss is the capability that goes into making a car and manufacturing a car all around the world at scale. provides capabilities for what we sometimes refer to as adjacent or related industries. One of the amazing things about Michigan is all the design engineers we have for power. Now, power, of course, drives a car, but it also drives turbines. It drives alternative forms of generation. It drives clean tech. Think about all of the manufacturing that we can do around alternative manufacturing techniques, smart manufacturing techniques. Now, it used to be that you took your manufacturing and you moved it offshore because it was cheaper. But the only thing cheaper than moving manufacturing offshore is to automate that manufacturing. So the use of robotics, mm-hmm. the use of end-to-end supply chain. And these are capabilities that don't just apply to the automobile industry. These apply to related industries like clean tech, like aerospace, and a number of other industries that I think we have a unique capability that other parts of the world do not.
You mentioned the term clean tech, and you write in your essay for The Next Idea about the alternative energy and clean tech sectors as having what you see as huge potential for Michigan's economy. Just what do you mean by clean tech?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, but clean tech is basically trying to create power with as low of emissions as possible. So there's a couple of things that everybody should know. One is there's a government standard that's in place from the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Transportation that says in the year 2025, a car is going to get 55 miles a gallon. And now that's over twice what a vehicle gets right now in the United States. More than that, the particulates that that vehicle is going to create is less than 25% of what it is now, so a quarter of what it is now. So it's going to get twice the mileage and one quarter of the emissions. That's what clean tech is. It's doing more with less. Now, I think about everything that has a motor that's a larger, something like a turbine that drives, it drives a power plant. Anything that flies, anything that travels, over land or over sea, and anything that's used in construction or heavy equipment is going to have a motor like this. Now, these you can do a better or worse job with this, but the technology to design this type of apparatus, this type of machine, is really something that the automobile industry has a leading edge at.
Now, you believe that probably what you feel is the most important piece of innovation emerging from the automotive sector in Michigan is something that we don't see. So as we go into the auto show, you're not going to see it, but it is manufacturing and supply chain developments. What's happening here?
What's interesting is it used to be in the old days that an automobile company would say, here's the spec, and all these little companies around the Midwest would make parts for it, and the parts would come together. And what's happened over the years is because of information, because of these networks where everything ties into each other, it allows these parts to be made in a much more customized way, right? So in the same way that we can do 3D printing and make something really unique as a prototype, well, what's happening in these industries is they're actually manufacturing vehicles with this. So in a sense, the distance between design and making something has been shrunk. The distance in between ordering something that's custom and having to have people assemble it in a very unique way has been shrunk because information technology allows everybody in that entire ecosystem to know what the other person is doing and to provide those very custom parts at the minimum cost just in time. So think about whether you're making a refrigerator, whether you're making a human organ, a transplant mm-hmm. organ. Any of this requires this ability to know exactly what the spec is and to be able to customize it in a very short period of time at a very minimum cost.
So who is driving this? Is this the auto industry that is pushing outward to get these innovations into other sectors, or are other sectors coming to the auto industry?
The answer is both. One of the things that I think is really funny is if you think about your smartphone and think about how it used to be your smartphone had to find a way to connect your car. And now, in a sense, the entire car is being sort of designed around your smartphone. So that's your entertainment system. It's your navigation system. It's your communication system. So in a sense, the car is being developed with a space in it for where your smartphone goes, but it's highly integrated. And the same thing is true for the smartphone industry. They're now developing these technologies with Bluetooth technology so it can do a lot of things within your car, with your laptop, with your pad. All these different technologies are integrating.
We want to see and discuss ways to help Michigan's economy. So where do we go from here? And what do you think is the biggest obstacle that keeps more Michigan automotive technologies from finding new applications?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is to look at what are the adjacent or the next door markets for the technologies that we currently have. And I think those the obvious ones are things like aerospace, the military is maybe a good one. And we have to say, what technologies do we have that we can repurpose or slightly reposition to move into those markets? And one of the things that did happen when the Great Recession happened is a lot of these what are called tier one suppliers had to look for new markets because the automobile market had disintegrated. And a lot of these markets are now starting to get traction. So a lot of these larger companies that aren't the big nameplate auto companies are starting to sell into these adjacent markets. So the first thing that we can do is look for opportunities sort of next door to those markets that we have now. We can use the MEDC, some of the government agencies, some of the associations that we have to help us go and prospect those and attract those to the states because the capability to do that already exists in our state.
And then the next step.
The next step, I think, would be to say what new kinds of industries could actually emerge from this. One might be something like using the data that we have from cars for safety. Safety-related industries. One of them might be for transportation logistics, actually being able to figure out what is the shortest way from point A to point B. One might be something that seems kind of airy-fairy, if you will, out in the ether, would be to use big data and to use big data to actually be tracking when people are moving over roads across the United States and actually to manage the flow of traffic in the United States. So traffic lights are turning on and off. And one of the things is the people who actually have the data, right, is the automobile industry because they're tracking warranties, they're tracking what's happening with the odometers, sure. What's happening in the black boxes in the car.
Well, we like to end these conversations with a question for everybody to chew over and think about. So, Jeff, what's your question?
My question is, when you look at your car, what else could be done with the technology on your car now?
You're going to need tips? Any you're going to make everybody really think that over, Professor?
Well, your car, you know, I would think about your car makes energy, your car makes heat, your car makes light. What else could you do with that car?
Priming the pump. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Jeff DeGraff is our partner in The Next Idea and a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. You can find his essay on the potential for Michigan's automotive innovations at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
This is Michigan Radio, your NPR news station. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this Monday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I'm Jennifer White. Coming up, new scrutiny on a federal program that's supposed to protect juveniles in the criminal justice system, and how Martin Luther King Jr. was viewed by the press in the early days and how its assessments changed over time. We'll have